This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And, you know, I'm thinking it might not be too pleasant these days on the other side of the bench in the U.S. Supreme Court. Some historic arguments over some very basic questions of rights and responsibilities under the U.S. Constitution playing out in the opinions of the court. What is turning out to be the biggest year yet for the John Roberts Court is coming to a conclusion this week. Another 5-4 decision today. Narrow, divided, the dissents passionate. The divisions seem more bitter somehow. The latest decision? The court says that the federal government has no authority to specifically oversee voting districts with a history of voter discrimination without continued explicit congressional authorization. In a 5-4 split, the court has ruled against Attorney General Eric Holder in the important case of Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder. Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act is declared unconstitutional. And Shelby County and other so-called Section 4 districts will no longer have to be specially accountable to the federal government for their elections practices. This applies to 9 states and parts of 6 other states that have a history of racial discrimination. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the 5-4 decision. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in a dissent delivered from the bench, said, "By scrapping Section 4, the U.S. runs the risk of halting any progress that's already occurred in ending voter discrimination." Joining us now is Heather Gerken, professor of law at Yale Law School, where she specializes in election law. Welcome, Heather.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
How important is this focusing just on Section 4? The Roberts opinion seems to take pains to say that the overall notion of the Voting Rights Act is upheld.
It did say that, although anyone who knows about the Voting Rights Act knows that if you strike down Section 4, you've basically put a stake in the heart of Section 5, because Section 4 determines who is covered and who isn't. And without that coverage formula, Section 5 is a meaningless document.
Can't the Congress go back and reenact Section 4 tests for individual districts based on historical data?
Congress could go back, according to the court's opinion, and do that. The trouble is we've all spent a lot of time thinking about this. It's very hard to figure out the right coverage formula going forward, at least one that is politically viable, because it would require Congress to say some jurisdictions and not others have engaged in discrimination recently. And, you know, it's hard enough to get stuff passed in Congress, but to ask Congress to do that makes it even more difficult.
But isn't the court having trouble with the idea that the federal government gets to unilaterally do this once the clock is started? The burden is on those counties to show that they are, you know, sort of just like everywhere else in the United States?
Well, the federal government is entitled to do that because the provisions of the Constitution that matter here, the 14th and 15th Amendment, specifically gave Congress the power. And that's really the irony of this opinion. There was no question that the framers of the 14th and 15th Amendment intended for Congress, not the courts, but Congress, to decide how to enforce the amendments. And what the court did today was second-guess Congress's judgment on that.
Although, is part of this a well-established notion by Roberts and some of the other conservatives on the court that the Supreme Court resents having to do Congress's job in various decisions, this one being one example, and would prefer that Congress deal with this, not the court?
Well, Congress did deal with it, and the Roberts Court nonetheless second-guessed it. Congress amassed a lot of evidence. Now, you can have debates about whether it was good evidence or bad evidence, but Congress nonetheless did do its job. It amassed exactly the kind of record that the Supreme Court has repeatedly said it ought to amass. And what the Supreme Court did today was second-guess that based on its own view about whether the South is no longer the South.
So to be specific, or to be clear here, you are opposed to this decision.
Well, I will just say that I think that what the court asked of Congress was impossible. So what the court essentially said to Congress was, you need to prove to us that there is current discrimination going on that allows you to continue with Section 5. But the problem really for Congress was this. If Section 5 was working, you shouldn't find much evidence of discrimination. That's what it meant to be working. A friend of mine uses the comparison. It's like having a patient on Lipitor and looking at their cholesterol levels. The cholesterol levels may go down, but that doesn't mean you should stop the Lipitor. So the court was basically asking for Congress to prove something it couldn't prove, which is, if we didn't have Section 5 around, would there be a lot more discrimination? And since we lack a parallel universe to run the experiment, there wasn't much for Congress to do here.
Although you could make the same argument, not to be argumentative, about police action, that because we have these special sort of martial law provisions and there's no crime, that's not an argument for getting rid of police oversight here. The framers would have a real difficulty with the idea of open-ended martial law.
Well, I don't think we're quite at open-ended martial law. I mean, I will say that of course, you know, Congress has to think about it, and the court has to give it a certain amount of leeway. But the amount of leeway that the court gave to Congress this time is far less than it has in previous decisions. So what we saw today from the Supreme Court was a departure from its own precedent regarding the Voting Rights Act itself.
Before we go, and we're going to get some reaction from people on both sides of this question in just a moment, Heather Gerken, what does the 5-4 decision say about the precedent here?
Well, the 5-4 decision, I think, is the death knell, at least, of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act as we currently see it. I think what the court has really done is put the ball in Congress's court, and we'll see if Congress has the ability to pass the legislation that we need to protect the voting rights of minorities across the country. You know, Congress hasn't been particularly good at passing anything of late, so I guess we'll see.
She specializes in election law at the Yale Law School. Heather Gerken is a professor there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Get reaction now. Civil rights leader Julian Bond joins us, one of the founders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the early 1960s that fought the early battles on voting rights. He later became head of the NAACP. He's now a professor at American University in Washington. Julian Bond, your dissent here.
Well, this strikes me as a terrible day for voting rights in the United States. What the court has done is can only be called retrenchment and backing away from the established way the country has decided to deal with discrimination at the voting booth. There's a proven record of discrimination in many states in this country. We could see during the last election these attempts at voter suppression nationwide in states both north and south. And so to imagine that this problem has been solved, or even more, to imagine that the Congress, which is so dysfunctional, could deal with correcting it, is just a myth. It's a dream. This is a bad, bad day for civil rights.
Also with us is John Nyman, the Solicitor General of Alabama, who wrote an amicus brief in support of Shelby County. John Nyman, your concurrence.
Well, I think it's important, John, to note that in some ways this decision was a lot more narrow than folks are going to portray it in the media. Shelby County had asked the court to adopt a very broad holding and say that Congress had no power to impose this particular remedy really anywhere in the United States, and that remedy is requiring state and local governments to pre-clear their laws with the federal government before those laws could go into effect. The court declined to adopt Shelby County's argument on that front, and that means that, at least for the time being, it's at least possible for Congress to protect voting rights in that same way. All that the court said in this case was that the current formula that Congress used to determine which states were covered and which states weren't wasn't really current. It was based on things that happened in the 1960s, awful things that justified the preclearance measure then. But the message to Congress was, look, if you think that it's sufficiently important to distinguish between states in this way, you need to come up with a formula that accounts for current realities.
Is there something cynical, though, about this decision in the sense that no one on the court probably expects Congress to either hear that message or take up the call to update the formula?
Gosh, I don't know. Most courts I am aware of do their own business, and they let Congress do theirs or legislatures do theirs. Certainly if I were on the court, my reaction here would be, look, all the advocates for Section 5 and Section 4, the coverage formula, are telling us that we should defer to what Congress does. That assumes that Congress is capable of doing things and making hard choices. Here, it simply needs to go back to the drawing board and make the hard choices that it's in the business of making.
All right, John Nyman. Julian Bond, John Nyman has a point here. Liberals often look at the court as a kind of a backstop for an intransigent Congress. It's up to Congress to do the work here, and it's not up to the court. What do you say to that?
Well, from time to time, I've looked to the Congress to do certain things, and from time to time, the Congress has done certain things. But if you look at Congress today, you can't expect it to do much of anything. It does almost nothing, and to think that it would address this question that's been put before them now, I just think is whistling at the moon.
Is that a separate argument, though, perhaps a separate challenge to be brought to the court, different than what Shelby County tried to say in this particular lawsuit?
It may well be a separate challenge, but it's a challenge nonetheless.
John Nyman says this is a more narrow decision than the media is going to make out. Do you go along with that? And if it's broader, how would you say it's broader?
It's more narrow than Shelby County wanted. Shelby County wanted to hear him discuss it, something much broader, much more sweeping. And he didn't get that. But he got something which is just as debilitating to the Voting Rights Act as it possibly could be. To get rid of Section 4, you're really getting rid of Section 5. And Section 5 is the heart of the Voting Rights Act. So I'm sure he's disappointed and wanted something more, but I think he got more than enough.
John Nyman, why don't you describe your view of the relationship between Section 4 and Section 5? Two commentators on the program have now said that without Section 4, Section 5 is essentially a symbolic abstraction.
Well, John, I think that's right, although I'm not even sure we have to say it's a symbolic distraction or abstraction. The way that the law is written, unless there is a coverage formula in place, Section 5 simply does not operate. So that's definitely clear. But the point is that Congress could go back to the well and amend Section 4, come up with criteria that may cover other states that haven't traditionally been covered, but perhaps in Congress's view need to be covered.
John, I mean, I appreciate your candor here. You're actually following the logic on some level of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her dissent, that if Congress does nothing, this is a nullification of the entire law.
It certainly means that Section 5 itself does not operate in the jurisdictions that were covered before the current coverage formula was declared unconstitutional. Now, there are other provisions in the Voting Rights Act, including Section 2, that apply nationwide and will continue to protect voting rights of all Americans. But as of now, Section 5 itself doesn't have any effect.
John Nyman is the Solicitor General of Alabama. He wrote an amicus brief in support of Shelby County in the decision today in front of the Supreme Court. Julian Bond, we'll leave it with you. John Nyman's argument there, I suspect, is behind your statement, this is a bad day for voting rights in the United States.
Exactly so. He and I agree.
And that's, I would suspect, to be a surprise today.
It's a surprise to me.
All right. Julian Bond is the former chair of the NAACP, now a professor at American University. In the 1960s, he helped create and lead the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which fought some of the early battles in voting rights in the United States. Thanks to both of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'd love to hear your response, your views on all of this. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. President Obama weighed in on this decision earlier today. Here's his statement. I'm deeply disappointed with the Supreme Court's decision today. For nearly 50 years, the Voting Rights Act, enacted and repeatedly renewed by wide bipartisan majorities in Congress, has helped secure the right to vote for millions of Americans. Today's decision invalidating one of its core provisions upsets decades of well-established practices that help make sure voting is fair, especially in places where voting discrimination has been historically prevalent. I am calling on Congress, the president said, to pass legislation to ensure every American has equal access to the polls. My administration will continue to do everything in its power to ensure a fair and equal voting process. A lot of news there, a lot of reaction. The Supreme Court's term, the Roberts Court's term, comes to a conclusion this week. More decisions tomorrow coming up. A member of the WikiLeaks team on the case of Edward Snowden and why Ecuador is the place to be for leakers like Julian Assange. That's next. And now to a little story we could just call...
Think about the days of me and you. Of you and me against the world.
Well, Robert Goulet says it best. You and me against the world perhaps sums up the confrontation right now between the U.S. government and Edward Snowden, the NSA leaker who disclosed how the U.S. is monitoring internet traffic, capturing and indexing what we do, who we speak to, connect with, for how long, without regard for where they are or if those being watched are American citizens. Snowden slipped away from Hong Kong to the distinct annoyance of White House Press Secretary Jay Carney.
We are just not buying that this was a technical decision by a Hong Kong immigration official. This was a deliberate choice by the government to release a fugitive despite a valid arrest warrant. And that decision unquestionably has a negative impact on the U.S.-China relationship.
That's Jay Carney speaking yesterday. And there is also more tension between Russia and the U.S. over all of this. Vladimir Putin says Snowden is now in Moscow, that Putin does not plan to hand him over to U.S. authorities, and that he is free to travel wherever he wants. And here's the you and me against the world part. Snowden has now received the support of WikiLeaks founder and fellow fugitive Julian Assange, who from the Ecuadorian embassy in London told the world yesterday that he has secured Snowden an Ecuadorian travel document that will allow him to travel on certain airlines now that his U.S. passport has been revoked.
Mr. Snowden has submitted an asylum application to Ecuador and possibly to other countries.
And Mr. Assange added slyly about his new BF, best friend, Edward Snowden.
He is in a safe place and his spirits are high.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange speaking from the Ecuadorian embassy in London. What is the relationship between WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and Edward Snowden? Earlier today, I spoke with Christian Rafson, a spokesperson for WikiLeaks, who wouldn't deny, he issued a no comment, in fact, that WikiLeaks had been working with Snowden before he got hired at Booz Allen to become an NSA classified information official.
Just as a matter of general policy, we never discuss any relations with regard to our sources or information that we might or might not be processing. So there is, this is an answer that is neither a confirmation nor a denial.
So you're not denying that there might have been some sort of relationship between Snowden and WikiLeaks in advance of him being hired?
I just gave you an answer that is the one that I give to all questions relating to these matters and WikiLeaks.
All right. Well, something obviously changed between the time he was hired at Booz Allen and what we're going through right now. When did the relationship between WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden begin?
I can simply say this, that after he stepped forward as and identified himself as the source of this very important information leaks, we stated publicly that we would support him and because we understood what he was going through. We understand the plight of whistleblowers. And we have done two things. A, we have connected our legal team with his legal team, giving him legal advices on extradition matters and asylum processes. And secondly, we've acted as a go-between between his legal team and various officials and government where he has sought asylum.
Christian Rafson, did Edward Snowden reach out to you or did WikiLeaks reach out to him?
I cannot go into details of how the contact was established.
Why would that be an issue?
It's just a general policy not to disclose those things.
How did you vet or determine to your satisfaction that Edward Snowden was somebody that you wanted to deal with? What was it about his information or about your encounters with him that led you to believe he was credible?
When you look at the information that Mrs. Snowden has submitted to the general public and the importance of it, you must acknowledge that this is one of the most important whistleblowers in history already. And what is surprising actually at this moment is that we are more focusing on his whereabouts and his travels and not on the real important issue, which is what Mrs. Snowden has revealed about the Dragnet surveillance and the attack on the privacy of individuals. These are the matters that should be discussed.
Although one of the reasons he's the most important whistleblower in history, as you state, is because he's a fugitive defying the U.S. government in a very public way. And by joining with him, you raise the profile of WikiLeaks, yes?
He is not a fugitive. He is an asylum seeker. There's a distinction between that. It is a fundamental right to seek political asylum. It is protected by international treaties and recognized by most civilized nations.
Is there some sort of relationship, some sort of consortium of political ideology here between the Ecuadorian government, WikiLeaks, and people like Edward Snowden?
Yes, it's a fundamental ideology. It's called the truth. And the call for government accountability and transparency.
Well, that's very eloquent, but is there a relationship between the Ecuadorian government and WikiLeaks regarding offering asylum to people like Edward Snowden? Should more people come forward?
People should come forward, and they will, I believe, in mass. Whistleblowers will come forward because the increase in secrecy that we are seeing in the latter years is just gone beyond any reason. And there's an important it's important that it is attacked with getting the information out.
All right, I'm surprised by your sort of open-ended offer there for leakers to come forward. Christian Robson, do you know where Edward Snowden is at this moment?
I cannot discuss his location or his travel.
Do you know where his location is at this moment?
I have an idea, yes.
Kristen Rofson is the official spokesperson for WikiLeaks. We spoke with him earlier today, and Rofson apparently shares some knowledge of Snowden's whereabouts with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who said today that Snowden is still in the transit area at the Moscow airport. Putin says that Snowden is free to go, but that Russia won't be handing him over to the United States anytime soon. All this hour, we're asking for your reactions to the Supreme Court decision on the Voting Rights Act today, a 5-4 decision by the justices ruling that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional. The act applies to counties and states that have a long history of racial discrimination. We want your take. Do we still need a provision like that in place? What do you believe about Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Prisoners of War. They are among the painful emotional burdens of a prolonged conflict such as the one in Afghanistan. They are also a foregone conclusion on the battlefield. In the Afghan War, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl is the only American prisoner of war being held captive by the Taliban. And his fate may be part of a proposed transaction that would exchange 5 Taliban prisoners at Guantanamo Bay for the release of Sergeant Bergdahl. It's the second time a deal to release Bergdahl has been in sight, and this time it may be more serious.
I will not leave you on the battlefield, Bo. These people here will not leave you on the battlefield. Your country will not leave you on the battlefield. You are not forgotten. You will not be forgotten. No. We pray that soon you will come home.
That's from an emotional rally in support of Bergdahl in his home in Haley, Idaho, last weekend, where the soldier's father, Bob Bergdahl, spoke. You heard him there. Joining us from Haley is Colonel Tim Marsano, public affairs officer with the Idaho Army National Guard. He's been working as the media liaison for the Bergdahl family for the last 4 years of Sergeant Bergdahl's captivity. Colonel Marsano joins me now. Hope in Haley, Colonel?
Yeah, good to be with you, John. There is a lot of hope in Haley. Over the course of the last few years, that hope has ebbed and flowed, but I think right now we're on a high.
What do you think of the trade, 5 Taliban for 1 sergeant?
Well, as far as the parents are concerned, they see this as an extremely hopeful sign. After months and really years of not hearing anything, to be hearing this comes as welcome news. So the possibility has certainly buoyed their spirits.
What do you know about the condition of Bo Bergdahl at this point?
It's impossible to say exactly how he's faring. About 2 years ago, a video was released by his captors showing him to be in fairly decent shape. And then fairly recently, there was a letter that came from him. His parents are very convinced that it is actually Bo's handwriting. So that helped lift their spirits quite a bit as well. And he seems to be doing okay, about as well as you can expect under the circumstances.
Bob Bergdahl, father of Bo, has made some comments recently that suggest that he and maybe some of the people in the community of Haley are weary of the prolonged conflict here and weary of the 4 years of captivity and want this war and this whole ordeal to be over, which is certainly understandable. Would you say there is a weariness settling in?
They want their son back. I mean, it's been 4 years of captivity, and you know, even though I work with the Bergdahls and talk to them regularly, you know, weekly, sometimes daily, I see them at their home, I'm on the phone with them, it grates on them. I don't even know exactly what they're going through, even though, like I say, I am that close to them. They're doing something that I don't think anybody else could understand. So weariness is probably exactly the right word.
Now, you're with the Idaho Army National Guard, and I can't imagine that setting up a liaison for POWs was ever in the mission of the Army National Guard out in Idaho. This is a first for you.
We take care of our military families, and the Bergdahls are certainly part of the military family. Very sadly, over the course of the last dozen years, we've provided casualty notification, you know, the proverbial knock on the door, as well as casualty assistance to many families. And personally, I've been involved with about 3 dozen. Most often, unfortunately, they're soldiers who have been killed in action. So this is an extension of that. It's not an easy task, but it's very rewarding as far as I want to be able to say that I'm very honored to do it. I am very honored to do it, to help these families in their time of need, and that's what we're doing for the Bergdahls.
Well, it's certainly a reminder of the sacrifice and the importance that the National Guards all around the United States have had in the deployments in Afghanistan and Iraq. Colonel, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Colonel Tim Marsano is the public affairs officer for the Idaho National Guard, acting as media liaison for the Bergdahl family, hoping for the release of Bo Bergdahl, held by the Taliban for the last 4 years. As the summer of 2013 begins for investors, there's been a terrifying echo of what preceded the great financial crisis of 2008. In the summer of 2007, banks and financial institutions were trying to sail their way through a so-called liquidity crisis, where cash dries up, money gets tight, and all the little boats find themselves deep in the mud rather than above the waves. Speaking of mud, see if you can decipher this.
If the incoming data support the view that the economy is able to sustain a reasonable cruising speed, we will ease the pressure on the accelerator by gradually reducing the pace of purchases.
That announcement from Captain Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke last week was one big factor that precipitated what's being called a miniature liquidity crisis, as the financial system tries to imagine a world without the Federal Reserve propping up the money supply. It's been a collective look down from what seemed like a comfortable ledge just a week ago. Add to that worries in China about consumer confidence and the backing of its own banks, a crisis in Brazil, and summer starts to look hot and dry. Gillian Tett, assistant editor for the Financial Times, joins us. Welcome back to the program, Gillian.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Are people afraid of what might happen if the Fed stops buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, essentially propping up the low interest rates and the demand for these securities?
They absolutely are, because if you want to use the nautical imagery again, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, and when the tide goes out, you see not only which boats are actually shipshape or not, but you see who's wearing trunks, to use that wonderful phrase that I think was coined by Warren Buffett, and you can start to see who's been taking very risky bets. And essentially, there is a widespread recognition in the markets that the yields on treasury bonds have been lowered artificially by the actions of the Fed. If the Fed withdraws its support, they could jump up, and rising interest rates could impact on the economy and markets in all manner of unexpected ways.
Do you believe that rising interest rates right now could shut off the sort of slight boom in the housing market that's emerged over the last year or so?
I think there's certainly a risk that it could temper the boom in the housing market. I don't think it would entirely crush it, because there really is a sense that the housing market has bottomed. Prices are rising. Perhaps more importantly, you have a lot of new investors coming in and buying up properties. The bigger question, though, really, is whether it's going to have an impact on business and consumer confidence more broadly, and whether it's a question of simply slowing down the recovery or actually killing it altogether.
Mm. Let's talk about the margin for error. Since 2007, when really nobody saw the precipitousness of the collapse coming, is there less margin for error this time around when suddenly things look a little shaky?
There is and there isn't. I mean, the good news is that nobody can accuse the Fed of not warning the markets very clearly that it does plan to tighten. So unlike 2007, when the bursting of the bubble came as a complete surprise, this time round, people have discussed it extensively. The flip side is, though, that unfortunately, it has been the Fed that has been propping up the markets to a large degree over the last year. The Fed did that in the hopes that they would buy time for the politicians to get to grips with the badly needed structural and fiscal reforms. That has not happened. And there's still no guarantee that if or when the Fed does start tightening, you'll actually see the necessary action from the politicians instead.
Are they over a barrel, the Fed, that if they do withdraw, it's just going to be a crash landing? Or is Bernanke really good at this warning business, and what we're seeing right now is a healthy contraction?
Well, frankly, they're walking a tightrope right now. And the problem is that everybody knows that at some point the Fed will need to exit from these extraordinary measures. They also know that, quite frankly, the kind of measures that have been put in place have created huge distortions that will need to be addressed and bubbles. But if they withdraw those measures too fast, they could end up triggering a crisis that would make those distortions even worse. So trying to find a way out of this very difficult situation is frankly going to demand an extraordinarily competent captain on the part of Captain Bernanke or whoever else succeeds him at the Fed.
I've got to put that one in stone. On a slippery tightrope in the pouring rain over a ship that's tossing and turning in the waves. Jillian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jillian Tett, assistant editor for the Financial Times, on the economy and the jitters in the financial system over the last few days. With all the legislative struggles we've been talking about, does President Obama right now have the political capital to deliver on this?
I'll lay out my vision for where I believe we need to go. A national plan to reduce carbon pollution, prepare our country for the impacts of climate change, and lead global efforts to fight it.
That's a weekend preview of a speech the president is set to deliver today on climate change. Not talked about much during the 2012 campaign, the president wants to make another push for new regulations curbing greenhouse gas emissions from coal and oil-burning power plants.
There's no single step that can reverse the effects of climate change. But when it comes to the world we leave our children, we owe it to them to do what we can. So I hope you'll share this message with your friends, because this is a challenge that affects everyone. And we all have a stake in solving it together.
Joining us now, environmental activist and former Green Party nominee for president. She's also a physician, Jill Stein. Welcome.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
So nice soundtrack, real sincere sounding voice there. Do you buy it?
Well, I buy it about as much as I buy that this was going to be the most transparent government ever, that the president was going to protect Social Security and make the economy more fair and, you know, bring the troops home. So, you know.
So a lot of cynicism from the Green Party nominee for president in 2012. The president will talk about climate change and pick up the issue once again. What do you think should be at the top of the to-do list in a real White House climate change agenda?
I think, you know, we need to start by telling the American people the truth. And that's not only that we have a serious problem. I think most people understand that now. But it's also that all of the above is not a solution. It's absolutely, you know, unscientific. It is deceptive. And it is a deadly policy. It's like saying I'm going to give my kid an all of the above diet, including some lead and arsenic and pesticides, plus some blueberries and spinach and things like that. So, you know, you can't give your kid an all-of-the-above diet. Poison is not mitigated by healthy food.
Can we explore the all-of-the-above idea there? You're saying that the president can't pursue a policy of more oil and gas development and a policy of fossil fuel emissions control and have any hope to succeed.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the most important thing to level with the American people about is that there's an absolute jobs bonanza that's waiting for us if we actually convert to a green economy. We need to do this on an emergency basis, not only for the climate, but also for the economic benefits. We could actually put 25 million people back to work at the same time that we solve climate change and, by the way, make wars for oil obsolete because we get off of the fossil fuel economy. So there's an incredible win-win here. We don't have to look farther than to Germany, whose economy is booming, whose renewable sector is on the way to becoming the major number one employer of people. We can do that. A recent study out of Stanford by Mark Jacobson showed, for example, in New York State, that we could be at a zero fossil fuel economy. We could be completely 100% renewables, not only for electricity, but also for transportation and heating and for industry uses. We could be there by 2030 and have it paid for itself simply by the health benefits that come from reducing pollution. So, you know, this is entirely doable. The American public is already there. The ones who aren't there, basically, are Congress, and that's no surprise because, you know, Congress is subject to the same influence peddling that the president is, you know, and there are hundreds of millions of dollars spent, for example, in the last election cycle on campaign contributions and lobbying.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment.
Buyout policy.
Have you given up on this president, and have the American people given up on things like cap and trade and the kinds of reduction of fossil fuels that you've called for?
Yes, and indeed, you know, cap and trade, I think, wasn't going to do it, and the track record of cap and trade isn't good. But on the other hand, we have the example of a Green New Deal, which is, you know, you can look to Germany, you can look to Jacobson's detailed plan, you can look to the New Deal that helped substantially revive our economy. Now just make those green jobs, and voila, you have a solution to the economic crisis as well as the energy crisis. And this is what the American public is clamoring for. And that,
but wait a minute, how you move
Congress.
The president made these arguments in 2008 and all during the first term. And people didn't buy them. People didn't think that those jobs were coming from the renewable sector.
And they weren't going to, you know, because cap and trade doesn't really foster the development of small businesses. It doesn't increase employment. You know, it doesn't make the economic transition that we need to make. Cap and trade is a very Wall Street friendly expansion of the gambling economy, you know, and it basically puts energy into that gambling sector. So it really didn't have a leg to stand on. It's no surprise that the president couldn't rally support behind it. But if he instead made his objective here actually creating jobs, putting everyone back to work, eliminating unemployment, this is what the American people are already clamoring for. So if he could really speak to those needs and clarify how it pays for itself by reducing health costs, also by making wars for oil obsolete so that we could in fact military expenditures.
Respond to the question, though. Have you given up on this president? Are you still ambivalent about Barack Obama and the question of the green agenda?
I have not given up on the American people, and that's what is going to drive this president to do the right thing.
But you have given up on Barack Obama.
Well, you know, I didn't particularly have faith that Barack Obama was going to do the right thing, given who his funders were from the start. You know, it was above all Wall Street, fossil fuels, pharmaceutical companies, the usual suspects. But look what we achieved under Richard Nixon, you know, one of the worst, most regressive Republican presidents ever. We got the EPA. We got the Clean Air Act. We brought the troops home from Vietnam. We actually got women's right to choose under the Supreme Court because we had an engaged American public. You know, why were they engaged? A whole variety of reasons. But the president could play an enormous role in reengaging the American public by telling them the truth and by rallying for real change, not the window dressing that he's talking about by regulating coal plants.
We're remembering the possibility of political change during the Nixon years. Jill Stein is an environmental activist and the former Green Party nominee for president. She's also a physician. Thanks so much. One of the remaining cases before the U.S. Supreme Court in this term is the result of a political miscalculation by gay activists in California back in 2008. Overwhelming support for candidate Barack Obama among African-American voters would translate into defeat for ballot measure 8. Defining marriage as exclusively a union between a man and a woman. Didn't turn out that way.
One of the missteps was the assumption made by the gay community that by framing marriage equality as a civil right, that automatically the African-American community would overwhelmingly support it.
That's the Reverend Eric P. Lee, a leader in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Los Angeles. He awaits the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court challenging Proposition 8. But other states did not wait. In the 2012 election, Maryland voted on Question 6 and became one of the first states to explicitly legalize same-sex marriage through a ballot measure. What happened in Maryland politically that did not happen in supposedly liberal California is the subject of a new documentary from filmmaker Yoruba Richen, The New Black. Welcome.
Thank you.
What did happen in Maryland that did not seem to happen in California?
Well, I think what happened in Maryland in the 2012 election is that a lesson was learned from the mistakes of Prop 8. And a few things. First off, the assumption that African Americans were automatically going to support marriage equality because of their own history of, you know, oppression was a bitter lesson that they learned wasn't the case. And in Maryland, they really did outreach and work within the African American community and within churches, which are a big influence in Maryland, to talk and engage people where they were on the issue. And not only that, but Black LGBT folks were at the forefront of the organizing and then going door to door and church to church and community to community.
And that was the case in California, where conservatives targeted Black churches to try to make sure people understood that there was a moral question and a moral assumption being made about them, and that they should go to the polls and vote for Proposition 8. Now, in the case of Maryland, let's remind ourselves of just how important and significant the Black church is, both morally and politically, in the African-American community. Here's a clip from your film.
Well, you could go to a job and they call you boy, and they call you Jim, and then you come to your church and your name is Deacon James Jones. But the end result of that is, in order oftentimes for people who have been trampled upon to feel powerful, there's a need to trample upon someone else.
Now, that's Bishop Yvette Flunder of the City of Refuge United Church of Christ. What's she saying there exactly in terms of the power of the church and this sense of needing to trample?
Well, I think for African Americans, the church is more than just the church. It's more than just about religion. Obviously, religion is a big part of it. But it really is the sort of repository of our civil rights movement. It's where our organizing took place. It's places where we spaces where we were allowed to be, to commune. And it was spaces where we also felt powerful in a society that didn't give us power. So even if you are not particularly, you know, religious, the church still has influence. So that's what she's talking about, the moral sway of the church. And, you know, like every other group that we've seen all through history, all through society, the oppressed can often become the oppressors. And I think for a lot of us, with Prop 8 and gay marriage and gay rights issue in general, there's some consternation or irony that the church, which is the, you know, has advocated for our rights, is advocating against other people's rights.
You know, one of the things that comes out in this film, The New Black, is the extent to which, even though this is a divisive issue, even though this is a controversial issue, within the Black church, there is a forum to listen to new ideas, even if sometimes those ideas are controversial. I'm going to play a couple of voices here.
You as a Black man have the opportunity to stand up for somebody else. Whether you're gay or not, these are your brothers and sisters out here, and they need you to represent.
What's going on there? There's a sort of canvassing, campaigning going on.
Exactly. We feature some young activists in the film, and this is an activist named Caress Taylor Hughes, who has been working on this issue really for the last 3 years. She worked on it in North Carolina as well, where there was an initiative that lost. But she is an organizer that has been going out and working particularly in Black neighborhoods and Black communities around this issue. And that's an encounter that we filmed with her and another activist, Samantha Master, talking to some young men in Baltimore.
And of course, because ballot measure 6 passed in Maryland, you know, these kinds of campaigns were effective. Here's another one. And here what you're seeing in this particular scene is the argument itself, the framing of the argument itself in religious terms.
In the Bible, there's so many things that we can say. Divorce is reprehensible in the Bible. Women are to be seen and not heard. Black people are supposed to be slaves. All of that's in the Bible.
I cannot take God out of my equation.
I cannot take God out of my equation. A woman by the name of Michelle. And was she convinced?
I don't know if she was convinced, but what was so amazing about that whole scene that we filmed, where there's multiple conversations in that room, is that we see, I think, the whole spectrum of people's you know, opinions and feelings about the issue, people who have family members who are gay, who are trying to reconcile their belief in God and what the Bible says with their love for their family members, people who are not quite there yet, like Michelle. So I don't know if she was convinced, but I think the conversation was the first conversation.
And that's the bigger question. Is the African-American community changing because of this issue? And is the church, like it or not, helping to lead the way on some level?
The folks who are black ministers who have been working on this issue, you know, they say, especially in D.C. and Maryland, where this has been for the last couple of years an issue because D.C. passed marriage as well, that, you know, that we have come far on this issue, that we have made a lot of progress in terms of our understanding, our conversation around it, but that there's a lot further for us to go. And quite frankly, I think that mirrors a lot of other communities in this country. If you look at the polls, you know, where gay marriage, not just marriage, but support for gay rights started and where it is now, we've seen a lot of progress, but we also know that there's still a lot of challenges that the LGBT community faces, and a lot of, even with what happens in the Supreme Court, there's still a lot more work to be done.
And all the people in this film very interested in what the Supreme Court does.
Exactly.
And we should learn that very, very soon. Yep. Nuruba Richin, director, writer, and producer of the documentary The New Black. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, decision time. Which is it?
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them.
Aw, can't make up your mind there, Hamlet? And how do we feel about Mel Gibson there? Great actor or unstable celebrity gone wild? How do you feel about Edward Snowden? Hero? Villain? Criminal? What's up with the U.S. Supreme Court and its non-decision on affirmative action yesterday? More like avoiding action, avoiding decisions. Ambivalence. Is this a crisis, a sign of dysfunction, or the poetic brilliance of a thoughtful mind? John Keats, in Ode to a Nightingale, is stuck between life and its opposite. Darkling, I listen, and for many a time I have been half in love with easeful death, called him soft names in many amused rhyme to take into the air my quiet breath. Does he want to kill himself, or what? Ian Leslie joins us now, London-based writer with a defense of ambivalence. I guess we'd call it a defense. His new piece for Slate is called Ambivalence is Awesome, or Is It Awful? Ian Leslie is also the author of Born Liars, Why We Can't Live Without Deceit. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
So,
glad to be here.
Ambivalence is a good idea, a sign that we're sort of stuck in the mud, or an indication of the complexity of the issues we're dealing with at any given moment?
I think it's inevitable that on most things we feel ambivalent. I mean, and being ambivalent about things is almost a sort of necessary part of the human condition. And when people aren't ambivalent about something, about a very complex or controversial issue, frankly, I'm a little suspicious. How can you be 100% certain that your view on something that is very complex and tricky and controversial is the right one? If you're not a bit ambivalent, if you're not a bit conflicted inside, because that's what ambivalence is. It's about conflicting arguments inside you that can't be resolved. Okay, so and it could be emotional, or it could be kind of intellectual, but these kind of mixed things inside you that don't resolve themselves into a neat shape. If you don't feel that about something complex, then I'm not sure I believe you. And B, if you do, I think maybe you would just enjoy believing a little too much.
Well, short of belief that the sun will rise tomorrow, what are you not ambivalent about?
Well, I'm not ambivalent about the fact that it's a great honor to be on The Takeaway, for instance, or that it was a good idea for the Americans to kick the British out. But there are certain things like, you know, the right to free speech, about which I'm pretty unambivalent.
Pretty unambivalent.
Well, yeah, exactly. There you go. I can't even resist slipping in those qualifiers.
Because
the moment I mention it, I can think of all sorts of exceptions and qualifications. But, you know,
what do you think about Snowden? What do you think about Edward Snowden? And what do you think about Julian Assange there in the Ecuadorian embassy in your city?
Well, the Julian Assange sort of I can't believe he's in this tiny little room. He's got an exercise bike that someone's bought him, apparently, and he's sort of withering away there. And he's gradually turning into a Dalek, I think. That's my theory. As for Edward Snowden, I don't know. I think possibly he was not in seat 17A on that plane on the way to Cuba, but he was strapped to the undercarriage of the plane in sort of Daniel Craig, James Bond style, and has somehow kind of escaped surveillance. Now, I have mixed feelings about Snowden. I on the one hand, I can see that he did something good. On the other hand, he betrayed some pretty solemn oaths. And I feel like that about a lot of these big sort of complex issues. I can see both sides of the issue.
I was wondering how long it would take for you to say, on the one hand and on the other hand. only 3 minutes.
It's my favourite phrase, as you can tell. And as I say, I'm not sure I really trust anyone who doesn't use that phrase or kind of fit. And actually, physically, people move from side to side when they're thinking through difficult issues. One of the experiments I cover in my piece in Slate is the scientists gave people two arguments on different sides of a difficult issue and asked them to read them. So they induced the state of ambivalence about a difficult issue. And then they put them on a Wii board, the gaming board, and so they could measure their physical movements. And they found that when they were thinking through these issues, they were literally moving from side to side when they were ambivalent. So, you know, ambivalence is something we feel quite physically as well as intellectually. It's something that kind of suffuses our whole body and our emotions as well as our thinking when it's happening.
Do you think that democracy helps us to make up our minds or chases us into unambivalent, unambiguous and, you know, black and white kind of caricatures of reality?
Well, it's interesting because if you kind of go with the conventional consensus about what's happened to politics, particularly in American politics over the last few years, is that things have become much more polarized and everybody's kind of stuck in these red camp or the blue camp, and people are kind of really butting heads on issues like abortion or gay marriage. But there's a very powerful theory or different take on the evidence from a political scientist that I spoke to, and he said, well, actually, it's the parties, it's the elites that have polarized. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party leaderships have become have moved to the extremes, particularly one more than the other, I think. But anyway, we'll get into that.
That doesn't mean
that actually the voters inside their heads have become more polarized.
Well,
lot more ambivalence.
Let's jump on that then. Does that explain why politics feels so irrelevant to day-to-day affairs, that people who are grounded in reality are much more likely to be ambivalent, and that people who are playing the show game of politics are much more likely to be, as you say, dishonestly pretending to be clear about something that's not clear-cut at all?
Exactly. And that's part of the point of my piece, is that politicians are not representing us fairly, you know, and partly that's our fault because we expect them to project this air of superhuman certainty about every issue. OK, so the idea that a politician could stand up and someone ask him a question about, you know, whether we should spend more on welfare or whether he should be for or against capital punishment. The idea that he would stand up there or she would stand up there and say, well, I'm not really sure. I'm going to have to think about that one. I mean, that would never happen, would it? And, you know, it would never happen, A, because politicians are in the habit of trying to be certain and strong and show conviction about everything. And B, because actually that's what voters want. We want our politicians to appear strong. I would like voters to give politicians a little slack here and say, hey, you know, it's OK to say I don't know sometimes. These are difficult issues. We'll work them out as we go along. But, you know, the chances of that are very low.
Ian Leslie is a London-based writer. His new piece for Slate is called Ambivalence is Awesome, or Is It Awful? He's also the author of Born Liars, Why We Can't Live Without Deceit. We certainly can't live without Hamlet.
Thus, conscience does make cowards of us all. And thus, the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought and enterprises of great pitch and moment. With this regard, their currents turn awry and lose the name of action.
Action, that's right. Action from the Supreme Court today in the midst of a to-be-or-not-to-be moment for the Voting Rights Act, a 5-4 ruling declaring Section 4 of that act unconstitutional. Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act stipulated that counties and states that have a long history of racial discrimination need special federal oversight. The court said that they don't under the current formula, but do you think we still need a provision like that in place? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tomorrow, we're expecting decisions in the two same-sex marriage cases before the Supreme Court, California's Proposition 8 and the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. We want you to get an early jump on all of our conversations. Is the legality of same-sex marriage a constitutional right in your view, or is it a matter best left to the states? You can text your response to us by joining our listener response network. You'll get one text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program, so your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. The question, is the legality of same-sex marriage a constitutional right, or is it a matter best left to the states? Courts will decide tomorrow. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.